12. Please make Wendy very welcome.
Thanks very much. Can everyone hear me okay on this microphone? Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people as the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and to acknowledge their elders past and present, including any people that might be here today. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. When we're undertaking these pieces of research and hearing from people who've experienced really significant harm, it's incredibly important to us to be able to leverage that work, to be able to influence policy and practice and to make really important systemic change across the sector. So it really is a great opportunity for us to come and talk a bit about the findings from our report. As Craig mentioned, the report that we focused on is called People with Disabilities Reporting Crime. The focus of it is really people with disabilities reporting crime to police, but we did look at the upstream and downstream factors that affect reporting, which obviously has enormous use in this forum today in terms of the way people are thinking about these things. So the other thing I guess to mention early on is this was done in the Victorian context. Also, it focuses on adults, but a lot of what it talks about is what it means to be first identifying crime when it occurs, secondly, how it is to disclose, and thirdly, what the justice system does when people do disclose, which, as many of you know, and I think I'm probably preaching a bit to the converted here, is pretty problematic, actually. We work within a human rights framework, obviously, and so living free from violence is a fundamental human right and one that is all of our duties to protect. So the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission is quite an enviable position for many reasons, but one in particular is that we're able to draw on the advice and expertise of our disability reference group to identify and prioritise issues in the community. And over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, access to justice has really been at the top of the priority list for that group. So we're able to contribute through this evidence base and the advocacy that we've been able to do around that. So the DRG is made up of members who have direct experience of disability, the parents of children with disability, as well as service providers and advocates. This report really came about because of the stories that they told us about people with disabilities and the particular barriers when they're seeking justice as victims of crime. But as an overlay, in talking about access to justice, the main thing that was in people's minds in doing this work was access to safety above all else. So this piece of work was undertaken in the context of the Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into Access to and Interaction with the Justice System, the Australian Human Rights Commission Equal Before the Law report, which many of you would be familiar with, and of course the Royal Commission that we're here to talk a bit more about today. So in doing this work, we spoke to about 200 key informants, victims of crime and people who provide care and support. And we visited many police stations across the state, which gave us really valuable insights into the complexity of pursuing briefs of evidence, particularly in particular settings where there's a real disconnect between services and police and the justice system, and also looking more broadly at other settings like education and whatnot. So in doing that, it was obviously quite confronting work, but it confirmed in a really overwhelming way what many of us know, is that people with disabilities face multiple barriers across a number of systems when it comes to accessing justice and safety. So we looked at both the reasons people do report and the reasons people don't report, including not knowing how or where to report a crime, not knowing that what has happened is a crime, which was something that was a really strong theme in the report, or not having any opportunity or avenues to report. In the data collect, it became very clear to us that this is particularly the case for people who are non-verbal, so that was quite a big area of focus within the report. One of the most striking examples in the research for me was a young man, David, who was assaulted multiple times in a community residential unit, and he was only able to report by chance because despite several visits from an independent oversight body, he was never personally engaged with. He had no robust communications plan. And it was only because someone who was visiting him, who had a communications board, was able to speak to the independent oversight worker on that day that he was able to actually remove himself from harm. Otherwise, and without the faith required to make that report on his part, he would still be there. We heard frequently about the normalisation of violence against people with disabilities, particularly for people in services, And I should say at the beginning, you know, when we're talking about this thing, we're talking about really horrendous experiences. That, of course, does not mean that there are not people working in the system and working in police who are doing their best. A lot of the problems are systemic, but that doesn't preclude the attitudinal and really problematic behaviours of some people that work in these sectors as well. So I'll just say that up front. There are some good eggs out there. So in terms of normalisation of violence against people with disabilities, particularly for people in services, including mental health services and services, aged care, I guess there's another one, educational settings, we heard that services and police may not pursue crimes, particularly where the perpetrator also has a disability or where it's seen as a way of managing someone difficult. One expert, Patsy Frawley, told us, where a person who does not live in an institutional living arrangement would call being whacked, being assaulted or being tied up, being unlawfully detained, it may be identified quite differently in the system. It may be considered an incident and dealt with internally. Another participant told us that in group homes in particular, something might be a crime but is not viewed by service providers to be serious enough to report to police. It might end up in a discussion with a carer who gets moved to another service, but it doesn't go any further. And one of the problems with that in Victoria and in other jurisdictions as well is where that worker then goes and how you trace and track that worker to make sure they're not abusing or exploiting people in other services. So there's an inbuilt tolerance that people with mental illness will experience violence. Another expert interview told us that they're in one scenario where they'd been, there was physical harm, scratching until they bled, intimidation, punching, and they were left to try and protect themselves. There was a lack of record keeping from staff members because the abuse was constant and wasn't considered abnormal. So where crimes are reported, police would often attend to subdue residents rather than pursue an investigation. And, you know, the flow-on effect from that, obviously, is that police are considered particular ways in services. If they're there to manage people's behaviour or subdue incidents, how would you have any confidence at all to report to them if you needed to? Particularly where they're seen to be aligned with service workers. I don't know how many of you read The Age on the weekend. Victorians think everyone reads The Age, but of course they don't. John Sylvester wrote about this Royal Commission and he referred to a particular... He was talking about Victoria Police and he spoke to Victoria Police Assistant Commissioner Steve Fontana about kids who were beaten and raped who would sometimes abscond and would abscond from the organisations legally obligated to protect them, and that the police were quite often unwittingly or perhaps wittingly complicit in the abuse. Too often, Commissioner Fontana says, the runaways were taken back to the institution or the family home without being asked why they ran away in the first place. The Royal Commission's heard from a witness who said, when he told police he would stop running if they stopped raping me, one officer responded by hitting him on the head with a telephone for being cheeky. He was sent back to the very home where he was abused. We found that acting out or resisting for people with disabilities in some settings often actually resulted in harm. The report found that violence committed by staff against residents can become pretty normalised, and like I said, I'm not talking about all services here. In some settings, violence can be justified as behaviour management or even seem to be in the person's best interest. Another participant told us that we condone a lot of behaviour as necessary, which could be otherwise considered criminal. Whether a behaviour management strategy or this is the best way to work with them is the case. A lot of things occur which are really assault, even if the behaviour management strategy is condoned, but as such, they don't generally proceed to police. So we heard from many participants about a correlation between the number of people on restrictive interventions, which includes physical, mechanical, chemical restraint and seclusion, and people with communication disabilities, which to me is completely horrifying, but probably unexpected. I mean, probably expected in some ways. And to the credit, the implementation of communication plans has been a particular focus of the Office of Senior Practitioner in Victoria at the moment, but that's at the moment. I think that that correlation is one of the things that really, really bothered me in this piece of work. In terms of that normalisation as well, one expert told us that in a recent project where they went to talk about respectful relationships in a service, they spoke to parents, staff and people who lived in the residential service. They showed them various scenarios where staff members display various behaviours and asked them, what would you call the behaviour? Very few identified what those scenarios were about, for example, threatening behaviour or assault. On top of the real, and I could talk about this all day, so you just need to turn my microphone on when I go over. On top of a real and legitimate fear of not being believed or being perceived as difficult, victims were reluctant to report because they were fearful for their safety. They have to continue to live in those services. Did not think they would be believed, which was in some cases a really legitimate fear. Were worried about losing support or being moved to a location that is further away from their family or is a bit frying pan into fire. They had a fear of losing children, where they made a complaint and were seen to be vulnerable, or of putting their families at risk. So David, that I spoke about earlier, was told by his carer that if he told anyone, the perpetrator would kill his mum, which was his only support person outside the residential unit. People who provided care and support, including family, were also often reluctant to report because they feared repercussion for the victims. They feared what would happen to their family members and children in the residential units before action was taken. We also found that a lot of staff were frightened to disclose or report because they'd spent a lot of time in that area. They were potentially also fearful of the perpetrator. They didn't feel like they had enough evidence to speak up without losing their own jobs, and they didn't feel adequately supported by the system around them. A lot of people, and this was service workers and also police, talked about thinking it would be too hard on the victim, and in some cases that was a very legitimate concern, but I would question the number of people that used a victim empowerment model in that process and actually took the time to determine what the victim wanted at that point in the process. We also found that services would often rely on a criminal threshold to determine whether to take action and to pursue internal investigations. So that goes to that issue of, well, we're not sure it's criminal, so we'll just put it on the back seat and worry about it later. That also goes to the issue of how you track bad behaviour through the system, how you record abuse, and how visible abuse is in terms of trends and patterns, and also the risk of particular perpetrators. We also found that services in a lot of instances weren't confident to push back on police when police failed to investigate. So we heard from some service workers who said, we've got a problem, rang police, never heard back. Or had police visit their service and police would say, this is a service problem, this is what we need from you in terms of investigation, come back when you've got all the information for us. One of the other things that overlays that was the experiences of many people, service workers, families and also police, who were of the opinion that service workers are doing their best in very difficult and trying circumstances, and it's not surprising they occasionally lash out. There were instances of police, and I should say again, and I'll keep saying this when I think of it, that there were also police who really, really did their best and were quite hamstrung by the information they were able to gather in particular settings as well. But there were instances of police failing to take reports, either because they made assumptions about the credibility of victims, including many cases where police had taken support workers aside to see if the person had all their marbles, because they doubted prosecution would be successful, or because in many cases they felt that they had no idea what to do. They'd had very limited training and they were actually pretty candid on this point. One police talked about not having had any disability awareness training whatsoever and finding himself in a situation where a woman had turned up to the police station in severe distress. She was non-verbal and the only option he had to do was go to Google, which is obviously completely unacceptable in terms of the way, in terms of integration of services in the local area, in terms of being equipped to deal with what we know, as Craig mentioned earlier, is a significant demographic when you're looking at victims of crime. Police told us they had nowhere to go for advice and did not know who to call for communications assistance or who to make referrals to for support. So the lack of clarity about who could support the victim led to a really huge inconsistency in practice. Quite often it was a stick you in a cab and send you back, call someone up to retrieve you, call your partner who was potentially the abuser to come and get you or to support you through the police interview. But, you know, as I said before, there are also people who were able to call on specialist services, particularly in Victoria, and I don't know about other areas, but we have specialist sexual assault units and they're better equipped than your general run-of-the-mill police force around how to deal with these things and what relationships across different services are. I've got to finish up, do I?
About 2 minutes.
Oh, I've got so much to say. What we see from all these examples anyway is that crimes are under-identified, they're under-reported, and when they are, they're often invisible in data and the records. Although the focus is on police, we did look at the upstream and downstream factors. So we looked at all the major issues about getting a brief authorised for prosecution. Some of these, I guess, were police had really, they'd made decisions very early on about whether a person would be credible in the court process. That was then amplified by the settings that some of those crimes had occurred in, so whether the witnesses, the other people living in those areas or going to school in those areas, had the same level of credibility as the target or victim. We also heard about services doing delayed reporting, and also when it came to prosecution, where police did get the brief signed off, there was a lot of resistance because in lots of sexual assault cases, we know that it's the word of the victim against the word of the offender, and here you're working with a particular power dynamic. Concern for the victim, which I talked about before, and also fear of costs of unsuccessful prosecutions, which was a technicality I hadn't considered, I suppose, although we did hear from a lot of police saying they pushed with all their force anyway. If a matter is prosecuted, many people with disabilities felt that the court system does not hold a uphold a basic right to be heard and to be taken seriously. So in 2011, the OPP reported that in 4 years previously, there were only six convictions for the specific offences of sexual offending against people with cognitive impairments. We heard that often cases don't proceed or are discontinued at trial stages, and it's usually due to the courts not accommodating the disability, the judge not picking up on issues with cross-examination, or the questions asked not being appropriate. Some of the examples of that, and I probably don't have time to talk through the examples, but we had a man with cerebral palsy who was reprimanded in court for not laying his hand flat on the Bible. We had a man who was a victim of historical sexual assault who used a light rider who was told not to use predictive text, which resulted in him being personally examined over two entire days. We had a woman who ran over the solicitor's feet trying to get to the witness stand, and a young man who was giving evidence who fell off a chair in the court onto the floor in front of the lawyers because it was not designed to support someone with physical disability. I might just skip through a bit of that. But communication access in the court system was by far the most horrifying aspect. We made recommendations in the report around giving evidence and what it means to use facilitated communication, augmented and assisted communication, what it means to use an Auslan interpreter, and a lot of problems in the trial process have been, and I'm probably speaking to stuff that Craig knows a lot more about, was about how independent and how credible the witness was where there was a third party involved. So the report makes the key point that people with disability should be able to access support when they need it for as long as they need it throughout the journey to safety and justice, and often they get little or no support at all. There's an increasing body of evidence, including recent work in Victoria, on the importance of empowerment models of service delivery and advocacy and of safeguarding and redress. We have a lot of evidence. The action to actually make the rights real is the gap, and obviously something that everybody here is very focused on now. So I'll finish there, but thanks very much for listening to me.
Thanks, Wendy. I think you're right that we have heard some of that before, but it doesn't make it any less shocking to hear it in that way. Do we have a roving mic that's going around? We do, with Meredith. So we just ask that you use that for questions so that we capture stuff for the captioners. Do we have questions? I just see one just here, front row.
Please be kind.
Thank you. I'm Cathy Daly. I'm a criminologist. I study institutional abuse and also sexual assault broadly. Two points, really. The first is that in the institutional abuse research I've done, a lot of the abuse involves those between among peers. And I think that's a really complex area, which relates to the second, which is how much do we want the criminal justice system to be involved in some of these cases. So while typically law reforms do go straight into we need more criminal law, we need more police, we need more prosecutions, maybe that's not the most optimal way to proceed in many cases. And particularly, you see this, I've seen it in cases where the police don't want to criminalize peers in those institutions. So it's actually much more complex. Mm. in the sense of how criminal law can and cannot enable the kind of change we'd like to see.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really like to put that on the table. Criminal law vindicates the wrongs that occurred, but it doesn't necessarily help people. It can make things worse. And that's why people are afraid to report in some respects. So it's that complexity that I think needs to be brought forward.
And I think, I mean, the interesting thing coming out of this report was that people's focus was on justice and safety, but safety was absolutely the first priority. And there's been a lot of move in Victoria, and I think more broadly, about victim-centric processes which rely on the victim's decision-making and what the victim wants in the situation particularly, which quite often is safety. Number one, I just want to be safe. I don't want this to happen again. And secondly, goes to justice and acknowledgement, I think. The focus of this work is really on the criminal justice system, but I understand that it is more complex than that for people.
Yeah.
Having said that, if someone is a victim of crime, they should have legitimate and equal resource to a criminal justice response, regardless of the perpetrator. Yeah.
Other questions? I might pose one to you, which is this: how do we change this culture of sort of minimising and normalising violence? You were talking about institutions using words like incidents for things that are actually rape.
Mm.
You know, how do we actually break that culture?
I think that's a really interesting one. I think that goes to, like I said, I keep talking about empowerment models, but I do think it goes to independence and empowerment. And I do think it goes to having really clear understanding from people about the processes that are required, I could talk about this all day. I don't really have the answer, to be honest with you, but I think it's a range of mutually reinforcing strategies that need to happen, and I think part of it is about people's attitudes towards disability, people with disability more broadly in the community, and the value of people with disability in the community.
And those quite shocking examples that you provided about communication access, the person who couldn't lay their hand on a Bible, what happened out of that?
I mean, what happens in that situation is a whole bunch of things. First of all, you know you're headed straight into a criminal justice trial where you will not be adequately catered for. You will be treated in a very particular way. I would say from the beginning that that's a very, very hostile environment for someone, and suggests to me that the awareness and flexibility around how that process will continue is going to be pretty problematic.
Do we have other questions? Dwayne up front.
Dwayne Grant from Leader of the National Ethics Committee Alliance, and also part of the Australian Process for the Alliance. It's more of a comment, I guess. Leader did some research about 18 months ago about people with disability, looking at them joining in on programs, and we found that Carlton and Esby people weren't joining in on these programs.
Mm.
Of the ones who did, they got a greater outcome in the Anglo community. And we thought that the barrier to this was around language and authenticity. But what we found was, after the research, was that the organisations, mostly government organisations or organisations that are supported by government, didn't understand their disability. They had no concept. And these were organisations that were specifically designed to look after people who lived with a disability.
Mm.
And what we found was that they just were not, that the people with disability were saying, they don't understand my disability. They don't understand that my capacity varies from day to day. They don't understand that I have language issues. They don't understand that I need communication devices. They just don't understand how to support people with a disability. And I think, again, this highlights in the legal justice system, again, that there's no real concept of when a person with a disability comes into these fora, how to support them in an adequate way that allows them to give them a voice.
One of the things we heard from quite a few participants was the frustration of going to the police station and spending the first couple of hours teaching the police about their disability and what the police needed to do, and had to do that multiple times. And police were very thankful and grateful for that, but, you know, these people who've experienced some pretty significant trauma, whose role it is then to educate the system about themselves. Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Probably have time for one more question. If not, then I might just pose you one last one, which is, if there was one thing that you could change in the attitudes of police and enforcement agencies to ameliorate this, to make it better, what would you change?
I think that some of the real value over the last couple of years has been seen, I talked about before, about new models of victim-centric policing, which look to victim empowerment models and having victims lead the process. That involves sitting down with victims, ensuring victims understand what the process is, what the options are. And I think, you know, there's moves in Victoria to move towards a victim-centric policing model more broadly, and I think that will have enormous impact on the way people who face particular barriers will be able to access justice.
Thank you very much.
Mm.